to this day, it is the most gut-wrenching thing I've ever had to do in my life. But it was the only way we figured we could keep the family safe.
From the NPR Reporting Collaborative Side Effects Public Media, this is The Workaround.
Stories of the difficult and sometimes shocking things people do to get around America's healthcare system and to get the help they need.
I'm Christine Herman.
And I'm Esther Honig. So, Christine.
Yeah.
What is this workaround? What workaround did you find?
So I had just gotten back from maternity leave, and my colleague tells me, hey, I heard this thing where parents of kids with mental health needs, they're giving up custody of their kids to the state on purpose because it's the only way to get them mental health treatment. So she just kind of said this like as a passing comment, like, this is something maybe you should look into.
Wow.
I mean, my first thought was, this can't be real. This can't be possible.
But it is, like, it is actually, it's happening. This is actually happening.
Yes. Parents are giving up custody of their children to the state because it's the last option they have to get them mental health treatment that they need. Their therapists and their doctors are telling them, your child needs a level of help that they cannot get living at home. They need residential treatment. But most health insurance won't cover it. And so when they've exhausted literally every other option, they find out there's this workaround. You give up custody to the state and they'll pay for it. Your child gets help, but technically you're no longer their parent. And advocates I talk to, they tell me this is happening all across the country, but it's particularly bad in Illinois.
How did you start reporting on this? What was the first thing that you did?
Well, I started just trying to find out, is this really happening? Can I find people who this has happened to? And that's what led me to Matthew Timian. He lives in Moline, Illinois. That's in the northwest part of the state. And what he had to do to get his son into treatment without losing him, it's really mind-boggling. Earlier this year, I visited them at their home, and Matthew, he asked me not to use his son's name because he's only 15 and he doesn't want this stuff about his childhood to haunt him down the line. But I met Matthew's son and I asked him about his childhood.
When I was born, my biological parents, they couldn't take care of me because the way they were.
He's too young to remember much, but there were issues with his family, with his biological family, with drugs and violence, and there was child neglect.
And then my grandparents took me in, and they were horrible. They were abusive. They were just horrible. Like, the things they did were bad.
So he was taken away from his biological grandparents as well, and he was adopted by Matthew.
But he was 3 years old, and I adopted him with my ex-wife. She left soon afterwards, so it was mostly me raising him.
Sounds like, I mean, his life's been pretty tumultuous. I can't imagine being passed off from one family member to another to an adoptive parent. I mean,
yeah.
So he's been through a lot, obviously.
Yeah. So this type of trauma early in his life, it just led to some problems in his development, in his brain development. And Matthew started noticing these types of problems pretty early on.
When he was upset, he would bang his head into the floor for 45 minutes. That was alarming, to say the least. So we end up developing ways to keep him safe while he's doing it.
Matthew says he would hold him and try to physically restrain him until he stopped. But as he got older, that became more and more difficult. And there was even one time when Matthew's mom was there to help. She ended up with a black eye.
I really started to push everybody away and shut down everybody else around me because I was afraid of being hurt again. And out of all the things that I've been through, I was just like, I'm not doing it anymore. And that's when I started, like, the emotions started getting bigger and bigger.
So when he was 10, that's when he started cutting himself. And that's also around the time he was starting to hear voices. Matthew sent me some images that he took of his son's journal. This was written at around this time. One of the entries says, I'm so mad I can hear the devil. I will become one of his demons. I will kill everyone I hate. I might kill you. Really scary stuff.
So he really started acting out. started acting aggressively and violently, pulled a knife on me, tried to start a fire in the house, tried to escape from the house in the middle of the night at wintertime, holes in walls, things like that.
And Matthew and his son's story is all too familiar to Tony Hoy.
You know, to talk about a child that has a pretty severe mental health disability, you could almost tell the stories that would describe him like a monster.
Tony Hoy is a mother who's had a very similar experience to Matthew raising an adopted son named Daniel.
He was severely neglected as an infant, literally starving and left for dead, which affected his brain and how his brain functions. We didn't know that there were any mental health issues early on. We were told that it was just adoption adjustment, you know, adjustment to a whole new family, a whole new neighborhood, whole new life. And so we kept thinking every year things would get a little bit better.
But she says that just like Matthew's son, things got really bad as he got a little older.
It was pretty horrific. He held knives to people's throats. He tried putting his fingers and his tongue in the light sockets. He broke doors. He broke almost every door in the house. At the same time, he's a little boy. And he didn't want to be that way. He didn't like being that way.
So when you're a parent in this situation, what do you do?
Tony told me they had developed this routine where if Daniel had one of his violent incidents, his parents would call 911 and an ambulance would arrive. They would take Daniel to the hospital. And after each hospital discharge, she says another therapy would be added to the list. So he was seeing a psychiatrist and getting individual therapy. They were also getting family therapy. He was going to a therapeutic school and art and music and play therapy. But soon enough, even with all of these supports in place, another incident would occur, and this whole cycle would repeat all over again.
So we thought, well, what else? You know, what else do we do? And there were no answers for us.
So how many times are we talking here? I mean, how often did they have to go through this?
11 times over the course of 2 years.
Jeez.
Yeah. And Matthew had a similar experience when his son would get into a really bad spell with threatening violence, with cutting himself. He'd bring him to the ER and he'd end up in the inpatient psychiatric unit, and this happened over and over again.
And it got to the point when I just said, you know, I can't do this anymore.
At this point, his son's therapist was telling him he needs more intensive treatment than he can get living at home. He needs residential treatment. So Matthew was hitting some walls trying to get his son treatment. He had found out his insurance company would cover only 1 month. And most places won't take a child if there's no guaranteed payment for at least 6 months. But Matthew had a family connection at a nearby treatment center, and he convinced them to take his son.
The insurance company decided that he no longer needed treatment. They said they were no longer going to pay. So the day that they quit paying is when he attacked another kid at the treatment facility and ended right back up in a psychiatric hospital.
So during the weeks that his son was in the psychiatric hospital, he was on the phone with treatment facilities and state agencies, even lawmakers, trying to figure out who was going to foot the bill for this treatment. How would he pay for it? It costs about $500 a day. And before everything could get lined up, the hospital had determined that his son was stable, and they told Matthew, you need to come pick him up. But Matthew refused because everyone involved in his son's care had told him he's a danger to himself and cannot be safely cared for at home.
This time I wasn't going to bring him back home, but there were no other alternatives. I don't have any family that could have taken him. So I had to leave him in the hospital.
And that's when the state's welfare agency was called in, because essentially they deemed what Matthew was doing, not picking up his son from the hospital, as abandonment, which is child neglect.
The scariest part about this was when they called me and I explained, I said, I can't bring him home. You know, he's pulled a knife on me. He started a fire in the house. I have a 6-month-old baby in the house. And the lady said, she said, well, you know, that's not enough. You got to give me more than that. You either bring your son home or we will take away him and your baby. And so that, you know, threw us all into crisis mode.
So at this point, a well-meaning social worker at the hospital who saw Matthew's desperation to help his son, he asked if he'd ever heard of a lockout. Basically, you can give up custody to the state and they'll take it from there. And he almost decided that's what he would do until he did a Google search on psychiatric lockouts and we came across Toni Hoy's blog. She offers consulting services for families considering lockouts. And Matthew reached out to her and she said, whatever you do, don't lock out your son.
Well, I mean, why not? I mean, he's in this horrible predicament.
So she learned from experience that this was a terrible idea. After Daniel's 11th hospitalization, the state's child welfare agency gave them an ultimatum.
And basically said, if you bring him home this 11th time, we're going to charge you with child endangerment for failure to protect your other kids. And if you leave him at the hospital, we'll charge you with neglect.
So that's when she figured out this workaround, the psychiatric lockout. Daniel would get the treatment he needed, it would be paid for, but they would essentially have to trade custody for mental health treatment. But they really felt like there was no other option.
So at what point do the parents, do they let Daniel in on their plan to, you know, basically give him up?
So Jim, Daniel's father, he told me he was the one to break the news to Daniel, who was 12 at the time, in the hospital.
I went and I told Danny that we were not going to pick him up. And to this day, it is the most gut-wrenching thing I've ever had to do in my life. It still brings up emotion. I mean, I was crying terribly. And I think Danny was crying because I was crying. But he said, I understand, Dad. You got to keep everybody safe. And it's still, just to even recall that scene, just gut-wrenching for me.
Daniel was transferred into the custody of the state. And they didn't even know where he was for several weeks. Toni says she packed him a bag of clothes and brought it to a shelter where she'd learned he might be. But he had already been transferred to somewhere else, so she wasn't his legal guardian anymore, and she couldn't be the one to make decisions for him.
Wow. So, I mean, she has no idea where he is. I mean, what was this like? Was she able to see him eventually? Could she contact him anymore? Did she have any rights like that?
So there was a period of 2 weeks when they had no idea where he was. And then one day, Daniel picked up the phone and called them. He said he was fine and had been placed in a group home. But what happens when you do a lockout, Toni says, they basically treat you like a criminal the entire time. So Toni says this was traumatic, and that's why she told Matthew, if at all possible, don't do it.
And what about Matthew's son? I mean, what happened to him? Did he lose custody?
Matthew lucked out, if you can call it that, because after spending hours on the phone, he heard back from the state program that he'd applied to. It's known as the Individualized Care Grant. It's got a really long application process, and it's notorious among parents with at-risk kids for being impossible to get. But he got it.
Most people don't have the tenacity to go through this process. I was spending easily 8 hours a day for over a month on the phone with people trying to get things working.
It almost sounds like parents who are fighting for their kids are being fought against every step of the way. You know, like they...
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what Matthew told me. That's exactly how he feels.
When Dylan Roof happened, that was around the same time as when I was trying to get my son into a residential facility.
And you'll remember Dylan Roof was the white supremacist who killed 9 people at a church in Charleston, South Carolina.
And I just remember saying to people, like, listen, I'm trying to prevent another mass shooting, but I'm getting blocked left and right.
For me, when I listen to this, Christine, I'm just thinking about, you know, your perspective as a parent and how much more significant the story is for someone who has children and how you would see this story so much differently than, you know, just thinking of your own family in this instance.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've thought about it. I think about it all day. I bring this stuff home while I'm holding my kids. I'm thinking about the stories I'm hearing from these families and what they had to go through to help their kids. And it, I mean, it's been very emotional for me to learn about it, just because of, you know, imagining what it would be like if I were in their place. And it could happen to anyone. It could happen to me. It could happen to any parent who's trying to help their child and running into all sorts of roadblocks along the way.
So I think my question, and I'm sure everyone's question who's listening right now is why is this still, you know, why is this happening? Why isn't more being done to close this, you know, just gaping hole in our system?
So it turned out there was a law that passed in 2014, and Toni was very involved in getting this legislation through. She and her son even traveled to testify at the state capitol to lawmakers.
I think I just want people to learn from what went wrong. If we can just change a lot of the things that are really bad and really harmful and really hurtful, if we can move that in a better direction, I think families will be better through the most stressful times.
So this law was passed, and it was supposed to stop this from ever happening again. Six state agencies were basically told, you need to come up with a plan for how to keep families intact while giving children access to the treatment that they need.
So has it worked?
Well, no. Since that law passed, 265 children have entered state custody through a psychiatric facility. And for about 100 of them, the state found the parents were not at fault for their child entering state custody for mental health care. My question at this point was, if there's a law to get these state agencies to stop these lockouts from happening, then why is this still happening? So the lawmaker who sponsored this bill, her name is Representative Sarah Feigenholtz. She called a meeting with the agencies earlier this year, and she said, well, this basically shows a lack of commitment. Now, BJ Walker, she leads the state's child welfare agency, and she says that's not true.
Nobody works in government because they're not committed, because it's not an easy place to work. We work here because we have a real commitment to finding creative and responsive ways to use the laws and the resources at our fingertips, the assets we have, to do the best job we can given the problems that are coming in.
So in response to the law, these agencies, 3 years later, launched a program aimed at providing support to families that get to this crisis point and are considering giving up custody of their kids. And the program is supposed to keep them from going through it, but they have to be willing to take the child back home, which for many of them, like Toni and Jim, that's just unthinkable given the possible dangers.
They're very frustrated. They're depressed. The child is frustrated. They haven't been able to pull anything off that's successful.
To get a sense of what it's like to be on the inside of these agencies, I also reached out to Deb McCarroll. She worked for the state for 30 years before moving on to her new role at the Illinois Collaboration on Youth, which is a nonprofit that represents child welfare facilities. She says many state agencies, their hands are tied because of funding constraints.
You try to figure out the best way to spend the limited dollars that you have. And state agencies, you know, they can't go out and advocate for additional money. I mean, it's set by the state what the budget is and what the governor does. You try your best.
So at this point, I got in touch with Heather O'Donnell. She's a lawyer who works for a mental health treatment provider in Chicago called Thresholds. And she says the real question we should be asking is so simple. It's been sitting under our noses this whole time. Why do we wait until kids like Matthew's son, like Daniel, are at a crisis point before there's real help?
What Illinois needs to put into place is a system that helps these families early on so that these kids never get hospitalized.
So what that means is preventive care and community-based services that happen before these situations erupt into a crisis. And in Illinois, she says those services are virtually non-existent. So of course, this all ends up in the place it was always going to end.
It all boils down to a really unsexy issue, but it is the fundamental issue. The money that the state pays us for reimbursement rates has to cover our costs and enable us to grow to meet the needs.
Basically, if the state isn't paying providers enough to even cover the costs of providing the care, and if the funding isn't specifically targeted to preventive care, then families are left without help until there's a major fire that needs to be put out. And her point is, families shouldn't even get to that point that they're considering a lockout and scrambling to apply for state programs that she says don't even have enough money to help everyone who needs it.
The take-home message is that our state is failing these families and kids. It is because the state has not invested in early treatment so that there's enough access to treatment.
And BJ Walker, who leads the state's child welfare agency, well, she doesn't disagree with this.
The problem in the community is that we undoubtedly don't have in Illinois right now the right number of beds for the right kids at the right time most of the time. That is an issue we've got to solve in the private sector.
She says lockouts continue to happen because parents run out of options. And these kids, their mental health issues didn't pop up overnight.
There's often been a slow growing issue, sometimes that gets more and more rapid, and before you know it, it's beyond your control.
Walker says those state agencies tasked with ending lockouts, well, last year they worked with 27 families. But the program doesn't have all the answers. So when Walker's agency gets blamed for lockouts, it's like when a pitcher comes in at the end of a losing game to save the day and gets tagged with the loss.
Well, if law could fix problems, we'd have a different world. What the law does is open up enough space so that people can use resources and figure out how to line up against the problems that are coming in the door.
So the interesting thing here, Christine, is that my story, my workaround story, also has a lot to do with mental health treatment, or the lack thereof, or the you know, incredible cost that's associated with it. What's interesting is that in so much of, you know, healthcare reporting, we always come back to mental health. And it's a topic in our news a lot when we have, you know, mass shootings, this topic of mental health and people getting those resources. And it's always just so hard to get. I mean, nothing seems to change. And why do we never turn around and say, okay, we need to, finally now, this is the breaking point. We need to start investing in mental health. Why does that solution never seem to come?
So everyone I've talked to about this issue says the mental health system in this country has been eroding for decades, and so it's not going to get fixed overnight. And I've been thinking about this a lot, like, who has the political power to bring about this kind of change? I mean, when we think about politics, we think about people with money, major organizations can hire lobbyists, but children with mental illnesses, they're like the most vulnerable among us. Who's going to speak up for them to make sure their needs are met? And to be sure, there are organizations out there, people advocating for change, but change is slow. And it costs a lot of money that a lot of states, frankly, don't have. I mean, especially in Illinois, our state is still reeling from having gone 2 years without a budget, without a spending plan that drove us into billions of dollars of debt. But the state just settled a class action lawsuit earlier this year, and the lawsuit alleges that Illinois illegally withholds medically necessary services from children with severe mental health disorders. And they settled in court, so even though there's technically no blame assigned, the judge essentially ruled that Illinois has to create services in communities for these kids in compliance with federal law. And this could cost hundreds of millions of dollars, but the state has to find a way to make this happen. And the longer we wait to solve this problem, the more children are not getting the help they need when they need it, and the more families will keep being torn apart.
So what ended up happening to Matthew's son?
So Matthew Timian's son, he was in treatment for about 9 months that first time. And he came home, and it wasn't much long after that his dad found out he'd been storing knives under his bed again.
Oh my God.
He ended up repeating this whole thing over again. I mean, as you can imagine, the psychiatric hospital almost doing a lockout because he couldn't find a facility. But he's 15 now, and for the past year, he's been at a different treatment facility in Missouri. That's where Matthew was able to find him a placement. And he's getting ready to transition back home and start school this fall.
Today, he told me, he said, "Dad, I think this is the last treatment facility that I'm going to need to go to." So he's seeing change in himself, and he's correct. There is actual change there. But it's still not over. You know, it's a long-term parenting. I mean, parenting never stops. And in his case, it's just a lot harder.
But Matthew's son also told me he worries about what might happen if he comes home and loses control of his emotions again.
I'm afraid of showing, like, frustration or anger or depression, because I feel like that if I do show emotions or something, like, I feel like that they might think that, oh no, he's going back to his old self and that he needs to be in another treatment center.
It's been a really big roller coaster, and I still have a lot of problems with it, because I know that all of my son's problems are not his fault. But yet when I look at him, I still see the little guy holding a knife threatening to stab me. So I have a really hard time separating those two people. My survival instincts tell me, no, don't do that. Don't engage with him, because you will die. But the logical part of me says, just because he did that once doesn't mean he's going to do it again, and he's been better. So it's very difficult.
And what about Daniel? Did his parents ever get him back?
So after the lockout, it took 3.5 years and a costly legal battle with the state. But yes, they did. In 2011, they settled out of court and they got funding for Daniel's treatment.
Wow. So how is he doing today?
What's amazing is that if you met Daniel and his parents today, you would never guess all that they've been through. I mean, Daniel's been out of treatment for several years now, and he's 23. He has a 2-year-old daughter. He works a job, and he moved down to an apartment in central Illinois to be closer to his parents. And Tony, for one, loves getting to be grandma and see Daniel and his daughter every week. And she and Jim say Daniel has surpassed every goal they ever set for him.
I don't know that we really knew what the future held for him. I think we really just hoped that he would have happiness and joy in his own life.
I just love having a relationship with him. Mm-hmm. I feel so privileged still that he's having a bad day. He comes over and talks to us about it. You know, it just, my heart just jumps with joy.
Gosh, it sounds like such a sweet family.
Yeah, but I think it's really important to recognize that Tony and Jim's story, they've got this, like, happy ending. But not every family that goes through this does. And they're not the ones that are jumping at the opportunity to talk to journalists like me who want to stick a microphone in their face and ask them to relive the most painful moments of their lives. And I think what Daniel's story goes to show is what is possible when children with mental illnesses get the help that they need and don't have to lose their families in order to get it.
And what about Matthew? I mean, I think it seems like everything is still really up in the air for him. What's his hope for his son?
He told me he just wants him to have a normal life. And when I sat down with his son and asked what he hopes for, I mean, he just wants to be a kid. He feels like he never really had a childhood. I mean, he's excited to move home and be with his family and get a cell phone, make friends at his new school and, you know, mess up and be able to laugh about it.
I'm hoping that when I do get outside of here, everything that has happened in the past, like everything that I put my family through, hopefully they can push that behind them and I can push that behind myself too.
And Matthew, he says he'll be doing everything he can to help his son achieve that.
Success isn't being cured. That's ridiculous. It's becoming able for these kids to actually be happy again. And, you know, just give these kids a shot at a happy life when they would have never had it before.
Thanks for listening to The Workaround.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, give us a rating, and tell a friend.
Thanks to Esther Honig for being my co-host. And make sure to listen to her episode of this podcast as well.
And thanks to Christine for bringing us this story.
The show is edited by Sadie Babbitts and produced by Matt Hodapp.
The Workaround is brought to you by Side Effects Public Media. We're a regional health reporting group based at NPR member station WFYI in Indianapolis, with contributing stations in Missouri, Illinois, and Ohio.
I'm Christine Herman.
And I'm Esther Honig. Thanks for listening.